You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity. Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking a really critical journey, I think, into the heart in anesthesia, a living engine room. Mm-hmm. For anyone in healthcare, honestly, or even if you're just curious about the body, understanding this central powerhouse, it's just fundamental, isn't it?
Absolute fundamental, yeah.
We're going to sort of pull back the curtain on the heart's structure, its function, but specifically, really, through the lens of anesthesia, which is often, you know, high stakes.
You really are.
It's about seeing not just what the heart is, but how every little detail impacts care when lives are on the line.
Precisely. And, you know, for anesthesiologists, having this deep, almost intuitive grasp of the heart, it's just non-negotiable. There's such an immediate link between the patient's hemodynamics under anesthesia, how drugs work in their system, and the actual physical anatomy of their heart. This isn't just like textbook theory you dust off occasionally.
Yeah.
It's the bedrock of safe practice, especially in those challenging cases, high-risk surgeries, cardiac procedures, patients with existing heart issues. It's truly core to what we do every single day. Every beat counts.
That's such a vital point. So our mission today really is to tour the heart structure, but more importantly, understand why each piece matters so much in the OR.
Exactly.
How these maybe seemingly small anatomical points can have huge clinical implications, changing things moment to moment. Okay, let's really unpack this. Mm-hmm. All right, let's start right at the beginning. Where does the heart actually sit? Normally, it's tucked into the middle mediastinum, and the apex, that sort of coiny bottom bit, it points towards the left. We call that levocardia.
Standard position.
Yeah, the standard. One source used a great analogy. Imagine parking a car in a garage that's slightly tilted to the left. That's how the heart sits. And this position, it's not just trivia, it's foundational.
Absolutely.
Think about putting ECG leads on correctly, right? Or where you put your hands for CPR. Central line insertions, even navigating a T-probe for those internal images.
Yeah.
It all assumes that normal position.
What's fascinating here is, while levocardia is the norm, the vast majority, we definitely see variations.
Mm.
And you have to adapt.
Like what?
Well, there's dextrocardia. The heart's actually in the right side of the chest, apex pointing right, happens in maybe 1 in 12,000 births, sometimes with Citizen versus where all organs are mirrored, or sometimes just the heart is flipped. And then there's mesocardia, even rarer, where the apex points straight down midline, often linked to other heart defects.
So clinically, what does that mean right then and there?
It's immediate. Dextrocardia. Mm. Your ECG leads have to be mirrored. Completely flipped. Otherwise, you might misdiagnose something serious or miss something critical. It's literally like trying to read a photo negative.
Right, like reading a mirror image.
Exactly. And T-views, same thing. You have to mentally reverse everything, like using a camera that's flipped backwards. Mm. Even placing a central line might need a totally different approach because the vessels might be mirrored too.
Imagine trying to thread that catheter.
Yeah, when the path is the opposite of everything you've learned.
That vigilance is just critical. What's maybe a common pitfall you've seen with these variants?
Oh, it can be subtle. I remember a kid, seemed like a routine case. Pre-op ECG just looked weird. Not obviously bad, but off.
Mm.
The resident thought, oh, bad lead placement. But checking the history, we saw isolated dextrocardia noted. If we hadn't caught that,
what could have happened?
We might have chased a non-existent problem or missed a real one during the anesthetic. But just mirroring the leads, ECG looked perfectly normal. Confirmed the variant, avoided a whole cascade of issues.
Wow, that really shows how one detail changes everything. Think about how quickly a small detail like this can change your entire approach. What stands out to you about adapting to these variations?
It's about always questioning, always being ready to adjust your mental map.
Okay, let's move on to the layers. The actual structure of the heart wall. The sources call it a three-layered fortress.
Nice analogy.
Yeah. So the outside is the epicardium. That's the protective outer layer, like the castle wall.
Uh-huh. Part of the pericardium, really.
Then the thick, muscular part, the myocardium, that's the muscular workforce, the engine pistons, does the actual pumping.
The real workhorse.
And inside, lining the chambers, is the endocardium. Super smooth, like a polished floor, so blood flows easily.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, these layers matter hugely for us. Take myocardial thickness. It's not uniform.
How so?
Well, the left ventricle pumps blood everywhere, right? So its wall is much thicker, much stronger than the right ventricle, which just pumps to the lungs.
Makes sense.
That thickness affects compliance, how easily the ventricle fills. A really thick hypertrophy ventricle gets stiff, needs higher pressure to fill up. That changes our whole fluid plan.
And anesthetic drugs interact with us.
Oh, definitely. Many agents, especially the inhaled gases, can decrease contractility, make the muscle pump less forcefully. Others, like ketamine sometimes, can stimulate it. So you're constantly balancing.
It sounds like a real balancing act.
It is. And then think about inflammation, myocarditis in the muscle, endocarditis on that inner lining. These conditions wreck hemodynamics. Anesthesia then becomes, well, you called it a high wire act. It truly is. Supporting his struggling heart without making things worse.
Very delicate. Okay, moving inward from those layers, we get to the chambers, the actual rooms inside the fortress, maybe.
How about more houses?
Sources say two pumps working in tandem, right side, right atrium, right ventricle, that's the low pressure pump, gets deoxygenated blood from the body, sends it to the lungs.
Simple enough job, relatively speaking.
Then the left side, left atrium, left ventricle, high pressure system, gets that fresh oxygenated blood from the lungs and boom, pumps it out to the entire body.
And clinically, this distinction is everything. If someone has right ventricular dysfunction, say it's weak.
What changes?
Our fluid management gets tricky. Too much fluid can overload that weak RV, make it bulge into the left ventricle, and actually reduce overall output. We might need specific drugs, maybe pulmonary vasodilators. Left ventricular dysfunction, that's very common. Might mean needing inotropes, drugs to boost pumping strength, just to keep blood pressure up and organs perfused. Understanding those pressures, CVP, PA pressures, and what they tell us about how these chambers are filling and emptying in real time, it's fundamental.
It's like interpreting the body's dashboard live.
Exactly. Like conducting a physiological orchestra, second by second.
All right, so blood's moving through these chambers. It needs direction. Can't just slosh back and forth. That's the valves, right? The one-way doors in a busy train station.
Perfect analogy. They enforce that forward flow, stop backflow, or regurgitation.
We've got four main ones, tricuspid and pulmonary on the right,
guiding blood towards the lungs.
And mitral and aortic on the left.
Pushing blood out to the body. Each one crucial.
And when they don't work, valvular disease.
Huge implications. If a valve is leaky regurgitation or narrowed stenosis, it completely changes the hemodynamics. We have to tailor the anesthetic precisely.
Give me an example.
Okay, aortic stenosis. The aortic valve is tight, narrowed. The left ventricle strains to push blood through. It's working incredibly hard, prone to ischemia.
So what do you do?
We have to maintain good filling pressure, keep that ventricle full, and crucially, avoid big drops in blood pressure, which would starve the muscle of oxygen. Contrast that with, say, mitral regurgitation, where the mitral valve leaks backward.
Different problem.
Totally different. There, we might want to reduce the resistance the heart pumps against, maybe keep the heart rate a bit faster, to encourage forward flow and limit the backflow time.
NTE helps visualize this.
Immensely.
Yeah.
Transesophageal echo gives us that real-time CCTV footage. We can literally watch the valve, see how our drugs or fluids affect its function right now. It lets us fine-tune things incredibly precisely.
Amazing technology. Okay, structure, chambers, doors. But what makes it all beat in rhythm? The coordination. That's the electrical conduction system.
The heart's internal wiring.
Yeah, the Wi-Fi network of the heart analogy works well here. Starts with the SA node. Up in the right atrium, that's the main router, the primary pacemaker, sets the pace.
The boss.
Then the signal goes to the AV node, the traffic light. It pauses the signal just for a fraction of a second.
Why?
To let the atria finish squeezing blood into the ventricles before the ventricles contract. Timing.
Critical timing.
Then bundle of his Purkinje fibers. Those are the fiber optic cables, spreading the signal super fast across the ventricles for a coordinated strong pump.
Clinically, this system is quite sensitive. Anesthetic drugs can absolutely trigger arrhythmias.
Ow!
Well, some inhaled agents might prolong the QT interval, raising the risk of certain dangerous rhythms. Opioids can slow down the SA node, causing bradycardia, and conduction blocks, breaks in the signal path might need pacing, temporary or permanent.
And surgery itself can be a risk.
Definitely. Yeah. Especially valve surgery. The AV node is right there in the neighborhood. Accidental injury is a known risk.
Yep.
If that signal pathway gets damaged, well, like the analogy said, the network crashes.
And if the heart's Wi-Fi network crashes, what's the first troubleshooting step? Sounds like you don't have much time.
You have zero time. Zero. First step is always, is the patient stable? blood pressure okay?
Mm-hmm.
If not, if they're crashing, it's often immediate electrical cardioversion.
Yeah.
Shock them back into rhythm.
Okay.
If they're stable, maybe a bit more time for drugs, antiarrhythmics, temporary pacing wires.
Right.
But yeah, the clock is ticking loudly. Understanding that electrical map is key to preventing problems and fixing them fast when they happen.
Got it. Now, all this pumping, this electrical activity,
mm-hmm.
needs fuel, oxygen. That comes from the coronary arteries.
The fuel lines of the engine, exactly. Yep. Wrapping around the outside of the heart muscle.
You've got the LAD, the left anterior descending, feeds the front wall, the septum.
Yeah.
Big, important territory.
Often called the widow maker if it gets blocked.
Right. Then the RCA, right, coronary artery, takes care of the right heart. And mm-hmm. crucially, parts of that conduction system we just talked about, the SA and AV nodes.
Yeah, an RCA blockage can cause heart blocks.
And the circumflex artery feeding the sidewall. These keep the muscle fed.
And the clinical implications, they're huge. Coronary artery disease clogged fuel lines is a massive perioperative risk factor.
Because
we're constantly balancing oxygen supply and demand for that heart muscle. Anything that drops supply, like low blood pressure or anything that cranks up demand, it's like a fast heart rate that can tip the balance into ischemia, a heart attack on the table.
So you're actively managing that balance.
Constantly. Avoid hypotension. Avoid tachycardia. Use anesthetics carefully. Manage fluids precisely. Be ready with drugs like nitroglycerin to open up those coronaries, or beta blockers to slow the heart and reduce its workload if we see signs of trouble. Preventing that engine from sputtering is priority number one.
Makes sense. Okay, one last piece of the puzzle. The pericardium, the sac around the heart.
The protective casing.
Yeah, like a snug phone case. Tough outer fibrous layer, inner serous layer with a bit of fluid. Keeps the heart contained, protected, stops it overstretching.
It's designed to protect, but it can become the enemy. Pericardial effusion fluid buildup in that sac and cardiac campanate. That's when the fluid squeezes the heart. Those are emergencies.
The phone case becomes a straitjacket.
Exactly.
Mm.
That protective sac turns into a straitjacket, crushing the heart, stopping it from filling. Cardiac output plummets. Blood pressure crashes. It's life-threatening.
So anesthesia in that situation must be incredibly tense.
Oh, it is. Induction is perilous. Many anesthetics lower blood pressure and sympathetic tone, which can make tamponade instantly worse. Often needs a very careful, maybe even awake induction.
Mm-hmm.
And then urgent drainage, getting that fluid out, either surgically or with a needle, is the only fix. It really highlights how even the heart's container is critical.
Wow. Okay. What a journey. Engine, fortress, train station, Wi-Fi network, power station, all these analogies, and they all fit this incredibly complex, resilient organ.
You really do.
It's just crystal clear that knowing this structure for anesthesiologists isn't academic. It's the absolute core of safe practice. The difference, like you said, between smooth sailing and a storm in the OR. Every detail matters. Position, layers, chambers, valves, electricity, fuel lines, even the casing.
It's all interconnected.
So what does this all mean? What's the big takeaway?
I think the takeaway is that the heart isn't just a pump. It's this living, dynamic system, incredibly sensitive to everything we do. The more deeply we understand it, how it's built, how it works, how our drugs affect it, how surgery stresses it, the better, the safer, the more individualized our care becomes.
Right.
So maybe the question to leave everyone with is, given all this intricate mechanics and how anesthetics touch every part,
mm-hmm.
what new questions does this spark for you about truly personalizing care?
Mm-hmm.
Especially when things get really critical. It's about moving beyond just following the steps and really understanding the individual heart in front of you.
A powerful thought to end on, really understanding that specific engine.
Exactly. Outro music fades in.
Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. And if you're looking for exclusive podcasts, early releases, and deeper clinical insights, you'll find all that at patreon.com/optimalanesthesia by Rennie. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one. Outro music fades out.